Hey, good evening, everyone. Actually, Bernie is completely spot on, because this was something I was going to start with. Why is the Book of Numbers called the Book of Numbers? And is that even the right title? And the answer is actually, no, it isn't. Because the Hebrew title of Numbers is Be'midbar, in the wilderness. And that is actually a more appropriate title for the story that you get in the Book of Numbers. So let's start with the title I've given it, the Book of Numbers. What happens when the standards that God gives us and the world that we live in collide? Because in the Book of Numbers, that's exactly what's happened. You read Exodus and you've got the escape from Egypt. The people of Israel have escaped from the world, so to speak. They're not slaves anymore. They've been taken under the wings of a Redeemer God, the King of Israel, who has taken them out of Egypt, even though they haven't actually done anything to deserve being taken out of the land of Egypt. All they've really done is been descendants of Abraham. And if you two were to ask, well, why did God do it then? A response Moses might give you would be, because he promised Abraham that he would. He promised Abraham he would give him the land and his descendants as numerous as the sand on the seashore and as numerous as the stars in the sky would come back to this land. And God doesn't break his promises, which is a key theme for Numbers. So we've had Exodus. In Leviticus, which Peter so brilliantly took us through in January, you hear the standards by which God wanted the people of Israel to live. They've actually spent 2 years. This is the second year that they are in the desert of Sinai, as Bernie said. They're on the mountain, Moses is in the tabernacle. And for the last 2 years, God has been telling them, right, this is how I want you to live. And he actually carries on doing this for the next few chapters of the Book of Numbers, right up to Numbers chapter 10, when the people finally set out. Can I have this lectern a bit higher? It's a little low. Sorry, everyone. Yeah, bingo, that's fine. That's fine, thank you. Yeah, so the reason it's called Numbers is because at the beginning, God wants a census taken of all the people of Israel who were able to serve in the army or go to war, as he puts it, because there wasn't really such thing as an army then, as we would understand it. And they're counted, and it comes up to just over 600,000. That 600,000 men, the Levites aren't counted, and the women and children aren't counted either. The Levites are included in a separate census. Now, that is why it's called Numbers. People have logged onto that and said, oh, it's all about the numbers. And to some extent it is. The numbers are really important. It's tribe by tribe, clan by clan, family by family, all these people counted. And this story would have been told to people who had come out of the exile into Babylon when they're reading this story. And they're all being told, you're in exile, only Judah's left, but you are all part of Israel. Are the numbers accurate? Almost definitely not. Because if the numbers were accurate, we'd be looking at 2 million people in this desert. God could provide for 2 million people in the desert. So let's not go for that argument. But any historian will tell you that there were no tribes that big in the desert. Some people have tried to use it as an argument to show that the book is made up. Probably a more likely explanation, and I choose this word carefully, is that they are saying there were as many people in Israel as there were in Egypt. Israel has conquered Egypt. If you look at it, if you try to count and look at the numbers in the Bible, it's never 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 equals 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. These numbers are all symbolic. But it's always important because in lots of chapters in the Bible, the people are numbered and their accounts are important. It's in Numbers or Bamidbar in the wilderness. It's in Ezekiel. It's in Chronicles. It's in Revelation, when the first fruits of God's creation are counted. So let's get on with the story then. In the first 10 chapters, we get lots of weird, wacky, and complicated laws. A lot of it is about the Levites and how they're supposed to surround the temple, the tabernacle, and stop the people from getting too close. Here's a quote that shows you what it looks like, or what some of it's like. The Lord said to Moses, "I have taken the Levites from among the Israelites in place of the first male offspring of every Israelite woman. The Levites are mine, for all the firstborn are mine. When I struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, I set apart for myself every firstborn in Israel, whether man or animal. They are to be mine. I am the Lord." And if you're interested, that's Numbers chapter 3, verses 11 to 13. Now, this looks strange, but I chose it because it's an example of the kind of things God wants the people to know. He is the Lord. He does have authority to make these decisions. The firstborn are his and the people are his. But you also get statements which are very well known. So where does this sound familiar? The Lord said to Moses, "Tell Aaron and his sons, this is how you are to bless the Israelites. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face towards you and give you peace. So they will put my name on the Israelites and I will bless them." Heard that before? Of course you have. It's one of the blessings which is read in church very regularly at the end of the service. It's either the grace, or often it's the blessing, which we've just read. God is all about the Israelites. He's a God of order, and he's a God who will bless the Israelites with his name. And we get other things which are recognizable. Seven lampstands are made for the tent of meeting. In Revelation, Jesus appears to John on the island of Patmos, walking among seven lampstands. What's the symbolism of that? He is the great high priest, the true high priest. And any person listening to that would recognize it. And there are some wacky stuff too, like what a lady's meant to do if her husband thinks she's been unfaithful. That bit's pretty wacky and pretty woo-woo. She's meant to drink water from the tabernacle, which has been mixed with the tabernacle's dust. And if she's been unfaithful, her stomach will swell up and her thighs will rot. If she's not been unfaithful, she'll give birth. No, it does say that. It's in there. And you think, what's this doing in here? That doesn't sound anything like the God we know about. Well, apart from the fact that this wasn't written for us, it was written for people who lived 10,000 years ago. I think there's a very good chance things like that are in there so that if someone is jealous, they aren't able to behave as they like or start treating their wife badly and trying to insist to anybody who will listen and anyone who doesn't want to know that she's been unfaithful to them. That's a way of preventing it. You see, the rules God gives are for the benefit of the people and to show who he is and that he's concerned about them and that we all have to live together. And that's very important when we're the people of God in a world that has nothing to do with God. Because let's face it, in Numbers and now, the standards God lives by and the standards of the world we live in are completely and utterly different. In fact, I'll go as far as to say, the secular world and God and the church have nothing to do with one another. They're complete opposites. And whenever you try to put them together or try to make them fit one another, it doesn't fit, which is also shown in the book of Numbers. So we get to Numbers chapter 10. If you really want to know all the things that God told Moses and why he told them. You have to read it for yourself. But I do challenge you to have a look at this, because the one thing he's really keen on stressing is that he is holy and the people are not. That is why the main role of the Levites is to camp around the tabernacle and to keep the people away from it. You cannot come into the presence of a holy God. You cannot just wander into the tabernacle when, as and when you feel like it. You can't even go near it. If you do go near it, was the rule then, you will be put to death. Yeah, we do wish that wasn't in there. But again, this was over 2,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, more like. We cannot judge that by the standards of today. And he says exactly where the people should camp and how they should move out. He's a God of order. He's a God who plans things. But he's also a God of flexibility. Because in the 9th chapter of Numbers, they're called to celebrate the Passover. And they do celebrate the Passover. The Passover, which Jews will be worshipping now, will be celebrating in a couple of weeks' time, is absolutely essential to everything they believe in. But now it's time to go. So, Numbers 10, I've abridged this a bit, but we're starting at verse 11. On the 20th day of the second month of the second year, the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle and the testimony. Then the Israelites set out from the desert of Sinai and traveled from place to place until the cloud came to rest in the desert of Paran. They set out this day, the first time at the Lord's command through Moses. So they set out from the mountain of the Lord and traveled for 3 days. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them during those 3 days to find a place to rest. The cloud of the Lord was over them by day, and they set out from the camp. Whenever the Ark set out, Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord, may your enemies be scattered, may your foes flee before you." Whenever it came to rest, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the countless thousands of Israel." Now, interestingly enough, that prayer is still said today in every synagogue when they open the cabinet and take out the Torah for the weekly reading. Rise up, O Lord, when they take it out. Return, O Lord, when they take it in. The Lord isn't a remote God. Even in the Old Testament, we are seeing a God who moved with the people of Israel. But here is where the standards of God and the standards of this world crash right into each other. Because the first things you will see, if you've been reading this, is right up until Numbers chapter 11, the people have been doing everything Moses told them. Build the tabernacle this way. They built it that way. Camp like this. They camped like this. March like that. Well, that's a bit different, but Moses told us to do it, so we'll march like that. Now, right from the get-go in Numbers 11, the people are starting to whinge. We don't like this desert. We don't like this food. We miss Egypt. We want meat. We want fish. We want garlic. We want onions. We don't like this manna anymore. We're sick of it, and we don't know what it is anyway. In chapter 11, Moses gets really fed up and essentially says to God, "I don't want to do this anymore. I wish I was dead. How am I supposed to feed this lot?" God was quite cross too. And after appointing 70 leaders to help Moses, he gives the people meat. But what he says is, "I'll give you meat. In fact, I'll give you so much meat, you'll eat it for a whole month. And it will come out of your nostrils and you'll hate it." In other words, that's what you want. That's what you're going to get. And it's not the best thing for you, but you said you want it, so you've got it. It's not a great idea to demand that God gives you things you think you want. It might turn out that you get them and then discover it was never what you wanted. And a good number of the people die when they eat the meat. It doesn't say why. But this is the start of a pattern. The people whinge to Moses. Moses goes to God. And sometimes God has to deal with it by threatening to wipe them out completely. We'll come to that in a minute. But Miriam and Aaron also rebel against Moses. And it says in Numbers chapter 12, now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. Some scholars have said that's the only time in the Bible where that word could actually be abased, brought low, or put upon. Well, you don't say. So, rebellion, you can hear him groaning, can't you? Rebellion against everything. But still, God is leading them on to the promised land until we get to Numbers 14. The spies are sent out to have a look at the land in Numbers 13. They come back with a huge bunch of grapes. Actually, that's still on Israel's tourism emblem today. And say, oh, it's a lovely land, it's beautiful, but we can't go in there. There are lots of giants. There are huge people. The cities are fortified. There's no way we can get in here. And when Joshua and Caleb say, oh, shut up, you lot. Of course we can go in there. The Lord brought us in, didn't he? He brought us out of Egypt. He could bring us into the promised land. The people want to stone them for their trouble. And they're going, we should never have followed Moses and Aaron here. Let's choose a new leader and let's go back to Egypt. Excuse me, go back to Egypt? Where you were slaves? You want to go back there again? You must be joking. But this is something we can learn. When things go wrong, when being a Christian is difficult, the old way of doing things suddenly becomes so much more appealing. The time when you weren't a Christian, didn't have to worry about A, B, C and D and reading the Bible and what people thought of you, you really wish you could have that back. And then we get God's response. Numbers 14, verse 11. How long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me in spite of all the miraculous signs I have performed among them? I will strike them down with a plague and destroy them, but I will make you into a nation greater and stronger than they, God says to Moses. Moses said to the Lord, then the Egyptians will hear about it. By your power, you have brought these people up from among them, and they will tell the inhabitants of this land about it. They have already heard of you, O Lord, and that those people with you, O Lord, who have seen you face to face with your cloud staying over them, and that you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. If you put these people to death all at one time, the nations who have heard of this will report it about you and will say, the Lord was not able to bring these people into the land he promised them on oath, so he slaughtered them in the desert. Now, may the Lord's strength be displayed, just as you have declared. The Lord is slow to anger, abundant in love and forgiving sin and rebellion. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children of the sin of the fathers to the third and the fourth generation. In accordance with your great love, forgive the sinners of these people, just as you have pardoned them from the time they left Egypt until now. The Lord replied, I have forgiven them as you have asked. Nevertheless, as surely as I live, and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth, not one of the men who saw my glory in the miraculous signs I performed in Egypt and in the desert, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times, not one of them will see the land I promised on oath to their forefathers. No one who has treated me with contempt will ever see it. But because my servant Caleb has a different spirit and followed me wholeheartedly, I will bring him into the land he went to, and his descendants will inherit it. Now, he's not actually being unkind there. The people said, we wish we'd died in Egypt. We wish we'd died in the desert. You've betrayed us, Moses. You've betrayed us, God. God said, okay. You want to die in the desert? That's what you want. You will die in the desert. He has forgiven them because when you think about it, why did they say that? But then why do we say that? Why do we look at a prophecy God gives us or a promise that we see about something, and when it doesn't happen, we decide that it's actually a bit too hard for God. He can't really do it. I want to do something else now. If you do that, it's a wonder that God will ever use you again. But if you repent, he always does. But there are consequences to when you do things which are foolish or things which are unwise, as happens to the people here. A huge collision between the standards of God, trust me, follow me, however hard it gets, and the real world. Oh, no, 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 no. I want an easier life. I want a life where this doesn't have to be a problem for me. I'll make my own decisions, God, and you're supposed to support them. Which essentially was what the people were saying. We want to go back to Egypt because we don't like it here, and this is hard. This is the end of the first part of the book of Numbers. The people have turned away from God, they've chickened out of the land, and now they're in the desert again. Incidentally, a journey across the desert should only have taken them 10 days. 10 days and they'd be in Canaan. It's taken them 40 years because they fought back. We don't hear much about this 40 years. Suffice it to say, there's rebellion, punishment, and rebellion. But here's something interesting. As soon as you get to Numbers 14, where they've had this bust up with God, and the people have ignored Moses again and still tried to go into the land and been soundly trounced by the Canaanites who lived in the hill country for their trouble. Moses told them not to do that, but they still didn't want to listen. You get another set of laws about what they're supposed to do in the land they come into. What's that doing there? It's there to show, although they've now been condemned to wander in the desert, God's not turning his back on them. God is still going to carry on instructing them. You get all kinds of rebellions and trouble in the desert, and more than once, Moses has to talk God out of the idea of destroying the people and starting over again. Usually it's not because, oh God, you can't do that because you're a loving God, you're a gentle God, you're a kind God. It's, no God, you can't do that because you are God and you made that promise. If you break your promise, that proves you're not really the God you've told us you are. And of course, God never is. We'll move to Numbers 20 now because here's something interesting happens. Moses himself makes a mistake. The people have been whinging again. What a lot of whinger these people are. What is it now? They want water again. You can just imagine Moses going, oh, not again. Moses is told to speak to a rock, and this is what happened. So Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence as he commanded him. He and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock? Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with his staff. Water gushed out and the whole community and their livestock drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I gave them. These were the waters of Meribah, where the Israelites quarreled with the Lord and where he showed himself holy among them. Moses can't go into the land because he made that one mistake. Do I hear unfair from somebody? Unfair? Yes, it does seem unfair, doesn't it? In fact, it seems so unfair, I've come across quite a few Jewish writers who tried to get Moses out of it by saying, oh, well, you know, he struck the rock before. He thought striking it again would work. You know, he didn't actually disobey God. He didn't actually do something wrong. It's not like that. And that's not why God told him he couldn't go into the land. But here's what I think it actually shows. If you are a leader, you are held to a higher standard than everybody else because everybody is looking to you as their role model. As the book of Hebrews says, not everyone should presume to be teachers because they're judged to a higher standard, just like Moses is. You cannot be an angry, pushy, bullying leader, and you cannot push your people around even when it really looks like they've driven you to it. These aren't the standards which we can keep as a leader. We can only keep them with God. So, actually, what happens next? In Numbers 21, we have a really well-known story where the people are wandering in the desert again, and they're attacked by snakes. This actually happens at the beginning of part 3 of the book of Numbers, where the people start to interact with the nations and start to look different. They write to Edom and say, can we pass through your land, please? We'll go by the road. We won't take anything. We'll pay for any water we take. We'll just go through. We don't want to take anything. We don't want any of your territory. And Edom said, get lost. So they got lost. They skirted round Eden. At the same time, the Canaanites attacked them and took some of their people. That wasn't a great idea on the Canaanites' part because the Israelites attacked them and they lost all their territory for their trouble, which they'd actually taken from somebody else. But that's another story. But the people are still whinging about being in the desert again. And this time, God's so annoyed, snakes appear. And when the people repent, Moses creates a bronze snake, which the people look up to so that they can be healed. Now, that sounds a bit strange. A bronze snake you look up to, and where Jesus uses that in John 3:16 to show who he is and that he too must be lifted up. Sorry, that was John 3:15. Verse 16 is the next verse. As Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, so the Son of Man must be lifted up. There is nothing wrong with something physical about your worship to help you focus, provided it doesn't become a tradition, something superstitious, or an idol. In fact, the bronze snake does become an idol. Several hundred years later, King Hezekiah has to destroy it because the people are offering incense to it. In chapter 22, the people of Israel have turned up at Moab's door. And we get the wonderful story, which I'd recommend anyone reads, of Balak, the king of Moab, Balaam, the pagan magician, and Balaam's donkey. If you read that story, you will soon find who the biggest ass in that story is. Sorry, just making sure you were all paying attention. You do see God's attitude to Balaam when he goes to the king of Balak to curse the king of Moab to curse Israel, even though he'd been told not to. And when the angel stands in his way and nearly kills him, the angel said, I could have killed you 3 times, but I didn't because I didn't want to hurt your donkey. A donkey which saw me when you didn't, by the way, Balaam, which rather shows what God thought of Balaam. And the story is hilarious. Balaam goes up a mountain, makes a sacrifice. The Spirit of God comes on him. He curses Israel. Balak tries to get him to go somewhere else and try again. He blesses Israel again. Balak in a panic tells Balaam, oh, don't bless them. Don't curse them. Just don't say anything. And he still blesses them. He might as well have saved himself a lot of grief, old Balak, because that was all he got for it. The last blessing actually said that the people of Israel would crush Moab and destroy it. And a king would come out of Moab who would do all that. That's not a prophecy of Jesus, by the way. It's a prophecy of what would happen later in the Old Testament. But Balaam didn't learn his lesson, because in Numbers 25, we actually get the first real interaction between Israel and a nation where they're meeting with each other, and it means trouble. Balaam has obviously decided he wants to be paid, and so he sends the girls in. Now, this is a part of the Bible we don't want to read and we really wish wasn't there, but it's important. These girls hadn't come in to fall in love with the Israelite people, with the Israelite men, and to marry them. This isn't a love story. These women had come in because the best way to get the people to not be a threat to Moab anymore was to bind them to Moab. And to do that, they got the girls to essentially say, come to bed with me. I'll let you come to bed with me. But in return, I'd like you to come to worship my gods and praise them and be with them. Now, this is something we see in all of the Bible stories. Solomon made this mistake. Lots of other people made this mistake. It's not a criticism of anything feminine. It's just making this point. If you want to intermarry with people from other areas of life, excuse me, if you want to intermarry with people from other tribes, you will end up being made or being pushed into serving their gods, and you can't do it. You have to stay away from them. If you don't, you can't expect God to bless you because you're saying that you don't care about him anymore. This is really emphasized by the priest Phinehas, son of Eleazar, grandson to Aaron. Aaron's died by this point. Who, when he sees an Edomite woman and an Israelite going into his tent in front of everyone who are mourning because of this sin that's been committed, he goes in after them with a spear and kills them both. Now, that is something, again, we don't want it to be in the Old Testament. It doesn't fit with the do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, humble God. We want to hear God tell Phinehas off for that, but he doesn't. He actually commends Phinehas for that. Why? Because it's making clear how you cannot have God and the world. You can't have both. Sorry, can't have it. Interestingly enough, when Paul talks about being zealous for the law in Acts, he is talking about Phinehas. When Paul becomes a believer, he is just as zealous as he was before. But he's met Jesus and not the traditions of the rabbis. So in Numbers 26, they have a census. We're getting to the end, guys. We've only got 10 more chapters to go, and I'll only do an overview of them. But God asks Israel on the plains of Moab to take another census. The numbers are the same, but this time it's clan by clan, tribe by tribe. You get to the same number, but here's the important bit. This is verse 63. These are the ones counted by Moses and Eleazar the priest when they counted the Israelites on the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho. Not one of them was among those counted by Moses and Aaron the priest when they counted the Israelites in the desert of Sinai. For the Lord had told those Israelites they would surely die in the desert, and not one of them was left except Caleb, son of Jehaniah, and Joshua, son of Nun. God has kept his promise. God always keeps his promises. He promised to bring Israel into the land, and he did, no matter how difficult they were going to be. He promised that generation would not enter his rest, not enter the land, and they didn't. Interestingly enough, people, I think, would like the New Testament writers to say, no, that was a mistake. That's not how we are now. But if you read 1 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul sees that as a warning, not as a problem. And he gives you a long list of exactly what you must and must not do. Don't commit adultery, as some of them did, and were struck down by fire. Don't grumble, as some of them did, and were killed by snakes. So if you think you're standing firm, be careful that you do not fall. So we're getting to the end of the book of Numbers. How does it finish? Well, Moses can't be the leader anymore. So he asked God to appoint someone else. Numbers 27. Verse 15, Moses said to the Lord, May the Lord, the God of all spirits of all mankind, appoint a man over this community to go out and come in before them, one who will lead them out and bring them in, so the Lord's people will not be like sheep without a shepherd. So the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hands on him. Have him stand before Eleazar the priest and the entire assembly and commission him in their presence. Give him some of your authority so that the whole Israelite community will obey him. He is to stand before Eleazar the priest, who will obtain decisions from him by inquiry of the Urim before the Lord. At his command, he and the entire community of the Israelites will go out, and at his command, they will come in. It's happened. He's taken them. Now, just a couple of other points before we finish. In the last few chapters, we see the whole thing being wrapped up. The people of Israel go to war with Edom to take revenge for the fact that they did try to ensnare them. Sorry, the Midianites who tried to ensnare them and fight them. The Bible says it was a total wipeout. Well, actually, it clearly wasn't, because the Midianites keep popping back in and causing a great deal of trouble. So, as I've always said when we've looked at these in other books, you need to take the "they destroyed them all" with a pinch of salt. And there are some rather unpleasant bits about what to do with the women, who you can have. But I would actually argue they do show the horrors of war. Because if you've been in a war, you cannot just go into the camp again and be pure. You're unclean for several days. The people of Israel do actually seem to be getting it right now. If you jump back quickly to Numbers 21, you will see them being given water and singing a song about it, instead of arguing with God and demanding he give it to them. You see Phinehas make the right decision. You see the officers of the army making a gift to the Lord, the first time anyone's made a gift when they haven't been told to. But you also see something amazing for a patriarchal society. Daughters of the tribe of Manasseh are allowed to inherit. And we see God being flexible. He allows people who were unclean at Passover time to celebrate it differently. And he also allows the people of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh to set up home and set up camp permanently without crossing the Jordan, as long as their warriors go over. But he also orders the people, and they obey, to have a man stoned for breaking the Sabbath. These laws were serious. These laws weren't a joke. This is why you can understand, until you read it carefully, why the Jewish leaders got so upset with Jesus for healing on the Sabbath. The Bible did say you were supposed to stone anyone who worked on the Sabbath. You wonder why Jesus did work on the Sabbath then, until you read his response as to why he could do it. And we get our last Bible reading from Numbers chapter 33. God says to the people, he's told them how to divide everything up. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land, those you allow to remain will become barbs in your eyes and thorns in your sides. They will give you trouble in the land where you live. And then I will do to you what I plan to do to them. Now, this would actually have listeners of this wriggling, because they're in exile now when they read this, because they didn't do what they were told. He wasn't telling them to kill everyone, but he was telling them to make sure other gods didn't have a power base in the land, because if they did, it would lead to trouble, because the secular world, God and the church, do not have anything to do with one another. And whenever you try to merge them, you don't get proper Christianity. Okay, we're almost there. What can we learn from the book of Numbers? Essentially, that's all we need to do. If you want to read the last three chapters, you can, and it's just a case of wrapping a few things up. God is a God who cares about his community. He goes with them wherever they go. He tells them how to organize themselves. He tells them where to stop, where to start. God is the God of the universe. People who say that they don't like the God of the Old Testament really need to think, if a God really created the world, if a God really made everything, what right do people have to say, you have to do this my way? I mean, really? But God is a God who is compassionate, merciful, and gracious. And in the book of Numbers, I would argue, you see that again and again and again and again. Because if he was a pagan God, he really wouldn't have kept these people going. He would have wiped them out and started again on the grounds that they were a disobedient, selfish, stiff-necked bunch of whingers. When things get tough for us, we can look at the book of Numbers and say God was faithful. God kept his promises. And God knew the sacrificial system wasn't enough. Because one day, if you read through the book of Numbers, you will see that to sacrifice a lamb every day is a sin offering, in the morning and in the evening. And that's to sacrifice all sorts of animals for sin offerings and burnt offerings. One day, on Passover, as the lambs are sacrificed, a man hangs on a cross outside of Jerusalem and cries out, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, so that we could become children of God. His name, of course, was Jesus. But that, my friends, is another story. There is so much I could have talked about, so much we've not had time to go over. Any questions?
I think I've got the mic working now. Great.